This is Renegade Broadcasting. Happy Thursday. Already the 14th. Wow. Man, oh man. Anyway, I'm going to finish up this discussion on the theme of biblical numerology. And then we're going to start a series that'll take us well into next week on JFK. I did a series on JFK. My God, I think it was 5 years ago on Oracle. Wow. I can't believe that was 5 years ago already. This is going to be mostly new material. I'm also going to repeat one of the shows I did 5 years ago, but with lots more information. So much so that it now clinches the case. I presented something 5 years ago that I got, well, a little flack from. Some people thought I was off the wall. And over the years, I've gotten a few, mostly supportive, but I've gotten a few detractors. You know, that's to be expected with anything. But folks, with this new information, the case is closed. There's absolutely no question about it. And I would really like to hear from anybody after I present this who still doesn't agree. I'd like to know on what basis. How can you possibly ignore the elephant in the living room with this one? Anyway, as part of that, we're also going to be talking about the RFK assassination, which is, of course, intimately connected with the JFK hit. Something I've touched on, you know, quite a bit over the years, but never actually did my whole show on it, so... we'll get into that as well. But, you know, I'm going to be looking at some different aspects of the Kennedy assassination that I haven't really gone into in too much detail. I've touched on it, but there's a lot more info I've been finding out. So we'll get into that. Anyway, picking up what we left off yesterday, I was going through all the different numbers and their recurrent common usage in the Bible. Numbers that keep popping up in the same context, clearly indicating that the Bible endorses numerology or, you know, gematria. The idea that, you know, numbers have some magical connotation. Why is this a big deal? Because this is something Bible believers frown upon. And yet it's all over their damn book. People think that gematria, that numerology, is more endemic to the, to the Kabbalah, that it's something that that book focuses on, but, you know, not in the Bible. No. Long before the Kabbalah was ever committed to parchment, this damn book was teaching the same thing. But like I said, you know, it's that Yahwehian exceptionism where, well, he can do it, and that's okay. Just like, again, you can command baby killing and that's okay. Anybody else does it, it's evil. I'm so sick and tired of this. People need to snap out of their little fantasy world. But what they need to do and what they actually do wind up doing, of course, unfortunately, are two different things entirely. Are they ever going to snap out of it? Probably not. At least, you know, for the most part. They never have. As I said many times, the masses have always been asses. So why should we expect the future to be any different? You would hope it would be. You'd like it to be different, but it's just the nature of the beast, as they say. I don't see it happening, guys. I don't ever see it, ever see it happening. Fortunately, to bring positive changes in the world, you only need a small minority of people who are alert. But usually, unfortunately, it's a small minority of deviant psychopaths that make the difference in society. Just look around us today. We're up against a greater challenge today than ever before in human history, because today we have the masses who are not only in a coma and are clueless, but they're on goddamn psychotropics. And they have access, to the electronic propaganda machine called the TV. You didn't have that in past ages, either of those things. The TV set and the pharmaceutical products are two factors that, collectively stack the deck against us. I mean, it was never easy to wake up the dumbass freaking masses to begin with. But, when you have those two factors in there, just like Bertrand Russell said, in the future it'll be possible for governments to control their populations with minimal to no resistance because of the effects of propaganda and pharmacological products. So there you go. That's exactly where we're at. Propaganda via the boob tube and other media, but primarily that. And pharmacological products. Yep. He knew where it was going. He was part of the planning board, if you will. This had been their aim all along. Anyway, so the next number we'll look at, we left off yesterday talking about the number 10. The number 12 now is the next significant number in the Not So Holy Book, which seems to carry the connotation of the sovereignty of Yahya. There were 12 tribes, of course, of Israel representing God's kingdom on earth. Oh, please. And what a kingdom it is. There were, of course, 12 apostles representing the church, God's supposed modern day representation of his kingdom on earth. And what a kingdom that is. Anyway, some people have this notion, delusion, that the Christian church is something good and wholesome. I'm not even talking, Christians. That's a given. No, I'm talking about the general population. They have this idea that overall, for the most part anyway, there's been a few minor exceptions, but the Christian church, for the most part, has been a great thing, a blessing to mankind. Oh, the hell it has. There's been some good that has come out of, the Christian world. But that's the exception, not the rule. And the reason it's an exception is because the individuals that have brought about good have themselves been decent people. Like I mentioned yesterday, the couple I used to board with, this elderly couple, sweethearts, loved them to death. They were like my second or third, grandparents. Second, really, because my grandparents on my father's side died very young. So I really only had one set of grandparents still alive. So they were like my second set of grandparents. Anyway, just wonderful people. They were wonderful because that's just how they were as people. It's not because of the goddamn religion. Their religion did not make them wonderful. There's nothing about Christianity that makes people wonderful. It's, again, anything wonderful in it is the exception, and it, that wonderful nature exists because of the people themselves. But Christianity as a whole, the religion as a whole, ladies and gentlemen, far from bringing anything good, it's brought nothing but evil down through the centuries. That you have to spell this out to people just shows how incredibly ignorant they are of history, or for that matter, of current affairs. The crimes the Vatican in modern times has been involved in. And we'll get we'll get into that more in the future. There's a lot more to be said. But just look at history. They didn't call it the Dark Ages for nothing. My God, when you look at the horrific, tyrannical oppression that went on for hundreds and hundreds of years, ruining the lives, literally and figuratively, of multiplied millions and millions of people all across Europe. And people think Christianity has been a force for good in this world? God damn it. Anyway, many, many examples of the use of 12 in the Bible. We're told that there will be 12 gates and foundations in the New Jerusalem, the alleged headquarters of God's government on earth, made new, you know, the new earth. There will also be 12 angels, 12 names from the 12 tribes, 12 precious stones, and the dimensions of the city will be, again, 12,000 furlongs cubed. Also in this city, we're told that the trees are going to have 12 manner of fruit, apparently signifying that never again will the eating of fruit bring God's sovereignty and authority into question. Because, you know, we're told that sin entered the world because of the frickin' the eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, which the psychopath Yahweh himself put there. You talk about entrapment. I love that one, man. You know, in that story of the fall, Adam and Eve were the bad guys, yet Yahweh is the one that set them up. Anyway, hold on a second. I just lost my place. I was looking something up. Okay, yeah. So anyway, but notice, guys, the fairy tale language, the fairy tale, imagery. A tree with 12 manner of fruits on it. This sounds like, some little girl's frickin' dream inspired by watching Alice in Wonderland or something. You know, it's just so freaking ridiculous. And the fruit on the trees, we're told, are for the healing of the nations. Now, you have to stop for a minute and ask yourself a big, serious question there. The tree, this tree that we're told is going to be in the New Jerusalem, in heaven, right? With the 12 manner of fruits. Its fruit will be for the healing of nations. You got to ask yourself a serious question here. If this is supposed to be heaven, where everything is made new, we're all glorified now. There's no more sin or the effects thereof, right? Why would you need this fruit for the healing of the nations? Aren't they all supposed to be, quote, healed at this point? After all, this is supposed to be heaven now, right? That we're being shown. John is being shown a vision of the future that he's sharing with us. This is a picture of what heaven is supposed to be like. Do you understand what a serious problem that is? Reminds me of a passage in the book of Isaiah, also supposedly looking into the future at heaven. At a time where, All things are made new. Paul quotes from that and making it clear that that is, in fact, talking about the coming kingdom of heaven, right? And yet you read on in the Isaiah passage, Paul doesn't quote from this, but right in that context, another verse or two later, it says that, a man will die at 100 years old. You know, in other words, you're going to live to a long, ripe old age. That's heaven? We're just going to live longer? When, of course, so many other passages tell us that we're supposed to live for eternity. Look at how ridiculously contradictory the messages are in this book of nonsense. It can't get anything straight. And you wonder why there are so many divisions in Christianity. Thousands, just in this country alone, there's 3,000 goddamn denominations of Christianity. It was Jesus himself who said, wasn't it, that a house divided against itself cannot stand? Can you get any more divided than that? It's as divided as you can get. 3,000 divisions just in this country. Anyway, the next number of significance the Bible makes use of in this regard is the number 14, which appears to carry the idea of salvation and deliverance. The Israelites were delivered from Egyptian bondage, we're told, on the 14th day of the first month. Egyptian bondage. Once again, who were the ones in bondage, and who were the ones inflicting that bondage? Christ's sakes. I got to repeat that series on ancient Egypt sometime. Wow, man. That has to be one of my favorite set of notes that I put together. My favorite series. When I started digging into that, I just couldn't believe it. It was one wow moment after another as I was collecting all the info, putting it together. Holy crap. When you look at what they did to ancient Egypt, the parallels of what is being done to us right now, it's their old frickin' playbook, guys. They've been at this a long, long time. All the classic symptoms of a decaying society that we have today were found in ancient Egypt at the time of the Hyksos occupation. Holy Christ, it's unbelievable. Everything. It's all there. The destruction of their culture, the mass influx of foreigners, loss of jobs, hemorrhaging of the economy, the devaluation of the currency. I mean, just on and on. Crime in the streets, an apathetic public. Wow. Hoarding of wealth and ownership of land at the top. Jesus Christ. And even weather modification. Or at least, you know, modification of the environment. You know, creating a drought. Damming up the frickin' Nile upstream. Or downstream, I should say. You know, they dammed it up so it would back up and flood the fields. That's what caused the drought. It was floods. Or not the drought, the famine, excuse me. It wasn't from a drought. It was from a flood. Anyway, back to the number 14 here. In Matthew 1:17, the number 14 is associated with the first advent of Christ. There were three sets of 14 generations from the time of Abraham, we're told. And Christ, of course, is said to have been the great deliverer. So there's another association between the number 14 and deliverance. 18 is the next number we come across, which seems to represent bondage. In Luke 3:16, we read, Then should not this woman, daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath day from what bound her? Jesus clearly makes reference here to the number 18 for a reason. In Luke 13, 4 and 5, Jesus made reference to 18 people being in bondage to sin. Look how this number pops up again and again with the same connotation. In the book of Judges, we find the Israelites in bondage to their enemies on two separate occasions, each lasting for, guess how long? 18 years. This is deliberate, not by accident. Kabbalistic numerology, guys, goes way back. The number 30 in the Bible seems to carry the meaning of mourning, grieving. Israel mourned after Aaron's death, we're told, for 30 days, according to Numbers 20:29. Israel also mourned for Moses for 30 days, as we see in Deuteronomy 34, excuse me, verse 8. Moving on to the number 40, which seems to carry the meaning of trials and tests. Oh, yeah. Look how many times this number pops up with that same connotation. First of all, we're told that it rained for 40 days and 40 nights during the flood. A trial or a test. Moses spent 40 years in the desert, we're told. Again, you know, most of this crap is freaking fairy tales, most of these stories here, if not all of them. But it doesn't matter. What we're focusing here on is the number and its use. Its association with, you know, trials or tests. Moses spent 40 days on Mount Sinai, we're told. Israel supposedly wandered for 40 years in the desert. By the way, this idea is completely ridiculous, since the distance between Egypt and Palestine is only about 250 miles. Thus, this journey on foot should only have taken a few weeks or a couple months at best. And yet 40 years they wandered, you know. Are you kidding? It's so ridiculous. There's no way it would take 40 years to undertake that journey. But they put that number in there so it would fit in with their little magic numerology. That's it. All of this stuff is arbitrarily inserted in there just to meet with their Kabbalistic type of, you know, fetish for numerology. And then, of course, we have Goliath, who tormented Israel for 40 days, according to 1 Samuel 17:16. We're told that Jonah preached repentance to Nineveh for 40 days, as we read in Jonah 3, verse 4. And, of course, let's not forget, Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness to be tempted of the devil, according to Matthew 4:2. Look at all these usages of 40 with the same connotation, the same function. Can't miss it. The number 50 seems to refer to celebration and ceremony. The Feast of Weeks was 50 days after the Passover, we're told, according to Leviticus 23:15-16. In Leviticus 25:10, we find that the 50th year was a Jubilee year to ancient Israel. Pentecost occurred 50 days after Christ's so-called resurrection. Look at, again, all these same usages of these numbers. Probation seems to be the meaning behind the number 70 in the Bible. Touched upon this yesterday already. There were 70 prophetic weeks, as I mentioned yesterday, given to Israel to repent, their probationary period, in other words, that Yahweh gave them, according to Daniel chapter 9. And like I said, we'll look at that on a future show, because there's some very interesting things surrounding that alleged prophecy and the fake Messiah called Jesus. Of course, fake Messiah, that's kind of a redundant phrase, isn't it? It's all fake, but nevertheless, that 70 weeks prophecy, quote unquote, of Daniel 9 has some interesting connections with the insurrectionist called Jesus. Or I should say, he made sure events in his life played out in such a way that it seemed like he was fulfilling so-called prophecies in that chapter. We'll cover that in a future show. For 70 years, we're told, the Israelites were in captivity to the Babylonians. Tyre was to be judged, we're told, for 70 years, as we're told in Isaiah 23:15. So, again, looking back at all of this, if this is not pagan numerology, then what is? Why is this practice forbidden in other religions, or forbidden by the Bible in other religions, but accepted in its own religion? You got to love the double standard. There's some interesting parallels that exist between the events that supposedly occurred, both at the beginning and at the end, that have occurred and will occur, at the beginning and the end of the world, according to the Bible. And, you know, for the Bible dupes who accept that damn book as, you know, real recollections of actual events, past, present, future, whatever, this presents another big problem. Because now we have to wonder, or at least the Bible dupe should wonder, you know, is the great Yah a puppet master? If everything parallels itself, you know, from the creation account and you know, future events, when you see these parallels, does that mean that Yahweh's just a string puller? And, you know, we really don't have a freedom of choice? For example, when you look at the seven creation days, the first day, you know, earth and light was created. Looks like we got a caller calling in here. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Father, what's Charlie happening? I recognize Father, that voice, Vin.
Father Charlie, bless me for I.
It's going to cost you a lot to obtain forgiveness.
How you doing, man?
Yeah, what's happening?
I want to let you know your show comes through clear as a bell. And now when you click on the link to listen to it, your number comes up, so you know where to call in for sure. Not that needed that, because you gave it to me, but they put it up now. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's something new that it's a whole new setup. It took a while to get involved.
Well, it comes in really clear. Somebody sent you, and actually one of the reasons why I wanted to call in, and you mentioned, I think, yesterday, about the lottery and the people at Sandy Hook. When I heard you talking about the lottery, I said, oh, Charlie, got to know about that. And for the way things work, I said, well, maybe...
You know what, Ben, hold that thought. We got to cut to a break.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Excellent. All right, guys, thanks for the subscribe back.
This is a public service announcement.
There is a serious problem facing our world today. People are actually believing what they see on TV and read in mainstream news. This has got to stop, now. Jews own our media, and they are lying to us in order to achieve their objectives. The Holocaust, 9/11, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, the Charleston church shooting, and many more events were either Jewish false flags or hoaxes. Don't be a good goy. Get wise to the Jewish lies. Thank you.
Everybody, welcome back.
How you doing, Charlie?
Yeah, Vin, you were saying before the break.
Hey, I just, what an informative break that was. I just found out that Jews run the world.
What a revelation.
I had no idea. You know,
must have been an anti-Semite who made up that commercial.
Who was it? Who was it? I think it was Valaria said, if you want to know who controls you, or you know, yeah, just ask who you're not allowed to talk about.
Talk about, yeah, right.
Yeah, no, you don't have to go any further than that. That's the way that works.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, I heard Donald Trump wasn't allowed, what's his name? Benjamin Netanyahu told him not to come to Israel.
And he'd better listen. He knows what's good for him.
Well, I don't get my hopes up about anything, and I don't trust any of them because, you know, let's face it, nobody.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's all
$1 billion being a nice guy.
Yeah.
But that was pretty good when I heard that. I was like, really? Oh, because usually they're licking the wailing wall wearing a yarmulke.
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been a president that wasn't there licking the wall.
Oh yeah. Oh, on a future show, I'm going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln having done that. Well, actually, he didn't do it. He planned to. He never made it over there. But there were several other politicians from that era that actually went over there.
Well, you know what? You know a show you should play back again is the one that you did a long time ago when you talked about all the presidents that either died or almost died because they were against starting a private banking system.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
That was a really good show. It was one of the best ones. I remember that was an early in back in Oracle years.
Yeah, way back.
When you said that. You really should. There's certain ones that stand out.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And that was one of, I was like, wow. I didn't. And Jackson almost got his head blown off.
Yeah.
They whizzed one past his face. But it's really interesting. But, you know, the thing with the lottery. You know, a lot of people don't know how easy it is to do that, to rig it up. And they literally can rig it up right in front of you, where the people, you know, as long as all you have to do is have control of those ping pong balls. That's all it is.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because what
did you know that about the Sandy Hook thing?
I didn't go into detail about it, but between that fact where all these people were hitting the lotteries, and then the other people who were getting houses for free, they don't have mortgages. I mean, you know, that's, you know, how many people wouldn't go along with that? You know, yeah. That'd be hard. You know, you're talking about a $450,000 home, and they come up to you, hey, all you got to do is go along with this scam that we're going to do, and we'll give you a free home. How many are not going to turn that down?
Yeah.
Not too many.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a price, so to speak.
Yeah,
you know, everybody has a shekel price. That's the way that works. But anyway, with the ping pong balls, all you have to do is take out six that you want to win, and they'll take out six balls, and they'll have like some of them in a row, so it's not something anybody would really play. People tend to play different numbers away from one another, not that it matters. Well, most people don't know that. And then they take the other balls, and they take a syringe, and they put water in them. And they put them back in the machine, and they try each one to make sure, all they make sure is there's enough water in each of those balls so they never get to the top.
Yeah.
And then they put all of them back in the machine, and everything's bouncing around in the machine, and the average person on the screen, you know, that's watching, or even the woman, the pretty girl that's like, here's the numbers, you know, that nobody knows, that because you see some of them hitting the top. So you think it's on the up and up. And then the next thing you know, all six numbers, because the rest of them can't get up there. So that's how they rig that. The other thing is never let them read your machine. Never go to the lottery and give a ticket and say, could you see if this is a winner? Because that's like asking someone just to put the money in their pocket.
Yep.
You know, because all they have to do is say no. And then you try to hand it back to the person. They say, no, I'll throw it away. And they put it in their pocket.
It's frighteningly easy, yeah.
Yeah, it's frighteningly easy, and so that's how they do it. I wanted to tell you something about 9/11 that nobody really thinks about. You know, I was wondering why so many people are against what happened. You know, why they're so, like, if I show so much evidence, why they still don't want to know anything about it. And it's because a couple of years after 9/11, Nova came out with a show called Why They Fell. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but I remember years back, my son said, oh, we know why it happened now. And I'm like, really? You know, and they put it on the equivalent of the educational channel or whatever it is in your area.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting show, but they lied. And most people who watch that show actually believe it explained everything.
Yeah.
You know, except for people like me that realize that they lied about the show completely. So somebody had told me they had watched the show. You don't know what you're talking about. I watched the show on Channel 13 in New York. And no, they know why it happened. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And then they explained it, you know, how there was no, the center columns were nothing, what they did is they just showed an animation and they lied to the people. But it's not something anybody, you know. In other words, a lot of people are coming off by denying everything simply because they said, well, they said it on TV. This is how it happened.
Yeah, right.
And it was a complete lie. They just lied to us, and nobody really ever, you know, talks about that. It's an interesting subject just to watch the show because you could get it on YouTube. You could watch it. And, you know, once you see it, you really, you know, if you don't know, you're like, oh, this is it. That explains it all.
Yeah, yeah.
It really doesn't explain it all. I've been enjoying your rants on religion, and I think I said...
I hope it's converting you now. You're going to go up to church this
week. I think I sent you the one clip, and it was St. Augustine or something was talking about it. And, you know, I sent you, a picture of it where he says, and it's actually true. When you hear Christians saying that there's certain passages like licking Jew feet in heaven, they don't like that. But you can't do that because, you know, the gospel, the Bible, it's the word of God. And you can't pick and choose because it's his book.
Right.
So no matter, you can't say, I don't like this part. You can't disagree about it. This is what it says.
Jesus said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of mouth of God.
That's what I mean.
Oh. Yeah.
And didn't he also say to follow the Old Testament?
Yeah. Oh, sure. That's all he followed. When Jesus was here, that's all the Bible there was.
And who did he come for? The salvation of the Jews.
Exactly. He said it himself. Yeah. I love those Christians who say that. I don't follow the Old Testament. No, that's I just follow the New. And then they'll try to say
Jesus
that
Jesus said to follow it.
And they'll actually say that Christianity has nothing to do with the Old Testament. Are you kidding me? The Muslims do the same thing, of course. You know, they want to act like they're religious.
Absolutely. They all have that same problem, and you know, you can't fault any of them because they're coming from a deficit. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know yourself. You read it how many times?
Yeah.
You know?
You know,
but you really
like saying,
didn't read it.
I like my crap brown. No, I like it when it's dark black. I like it when it's a little gray. Hey, it all comes from the same behind, and it's all crap.
Oh, and by the way, that's another part. That, thanks that you brought up crap and the Jews.
Yeah, right.
Well, and the reason
well,
it
is good that they like that analogy because it fits them so well.
Well, one of the easiest ways to get sick, most people don't know that. Most of the time when you have some sort of what they call stomach viruses or you must age something, it's because somebody didn't wash their hands in a restaurant. It could be even somebody in your own house.
Mm.
You know, when you do number two, you need to make sure you wash your hands.
Yeah.
You know, sure. Urine is sterile, so that's not going to do anything to you. But fecal matter is extremely dangerous.
I think it's 90% bacteria.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and it's okay where it is. It's great to have that bacteria in your intestine.
Right.
But you don't want to pass it through your body because, first of all, you can wind up in a hospital, and it's an alarm system.
Yeah.
That the first thing that happens when your body finds that there's fecal matter in your stomach is to start purging the body of all the liquids to try to get as much bacteria out as you can. So
yeah.
People get diarrhea.
Yeah.
So and people don't know that, you know. So I mean, how filthy can you possibly think about drenching people with crap? You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. Most of the major problems have been caused by that. Things like polio, that's directly linked to how dirty our water systems were. That's really what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
So forget about just the fact that it's disgusting. You could die.
Yeah.
You know, so you fall into a sewer full. And every once in a while you hear about somebody in China doing that. And they're in there for a while and they get them out and they wind up dying because they've been covered in crap. Hmm. You know, you could die. And somehow you're going to make light out of it, you know. I mean, it's funny when a dog farts and looks at his behind because it's a dog, you know. But after a while, it's like, really? You're going to get this crazy about something that's really this dangerous and causes so many problems?
Sure.
Yeah. So that's really all I had to say, Charlie. I had enough. I every time you rant, Charlie, no matter what it is, I smile. Just so you know, I just like, well, there it is. What else do we have to say? Yeah. By the way, something else I found out. The book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, has had, you know, it was banned on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because of that banning, 10 million people have downloaded the MP3. You know,
that's backfired.
Yeah, of course.
Good.
Because once you ban anything...
10 million? Is it that many, really?
10 million, yeah. So anytime you ban anything, that's the first thing that people want to do is find out what it is.
Right, sure. So keep banning. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I had... Somebody had told me this is horrible, and they were gonna do everything in their power. And I'm like, that's great. But you know what's really funny about... Because what happened to James Tracy and stuff like that. You know... It's one thing to talk about it in the New York Times, but they never tell you. It's like all those sites that contradict 9/11. They never show you evidence or point to why this guy has a problem with anything.
Yeah,
they never say anything like that.
Right.
You know, I had a person just on New Year's start talking about Sandy Hook, and I had said, listen, there was a time that I was a liberal. I consider myself liberal, and I was against guns. You know, but once you realize that you may have to defend yourself. I mean, it may come the time suppose there's a nuclear war, and you know, you're going to have people, they're going to be eating everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, you need the weapons. Hey, I got to go, Charlie.
All right, buddy.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah,
take care,
great man. Hearing from you. Call again. Take care. All right, guys. Our good old buddy Vinny. How do you remember him from calling on Oracle quite a bit? And, of course, on other networks over the years. But, I get a lot of emails from him. Sends a lot of good information. Glad to be on his mailing list. Anyway, so just real quickly here, we'll mention these parallels. In the book of Genesis, of course, you have the 7 days of creation. On the first day, earth and light, we're told, were created. Yeah, whatever. But notice the parallels. You jump over to the book of Revelation. In chapter 8, you have the seven trumpets. The first trumpet deals with earth, you know. And then you have the seven vials in Revelation 16. In verse 2, you also have the earth being mentioned in reference to the first vial. So seven trumpets, seven vials, and then the 7 days of creation are paralleling each other. The second day of creation, we're told that the earth...
I get you back.
Me.
How did that happen?
Oh, are you still there?
Well, no, I hung up. I had a call that came
Oh, you know what? I didn't hang up on you, I guess, is what the problem is. Oh, geez.
All right, that's probably what the problem was.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Hey, I'll call you back when I have more time.
Okay, take you bet. Thanks, man.
Keep up the good work. Bye.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, man. Okay. Let's write this down. Okay, there it is. All right. Yeah, I got to remember that in the future. Something hangs up, I got to actually hang up, too. All right, let's see. So on the second day of creation, we're told that the sea and the air were created. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. But now notice the parallel with the seven trumpets in Revelation chapter 8, verse 8. It mentions the sea for the second trumpet. For the second vial in Revelation 16, chapter 16, verse 3, it mentions the sea as well. Day 3, we're told that land, vegetation, including fresh bodies of water were created. You have, for the third trumpet, you have rivers and fountains mentioned, Revelation 8, 10. As far as the seven vials go, Revelation 16, 4, you have rivers and fountains mentioned there as well. This is all deliberate. But again, for those that accept the Bible as a true account of the past, present, future, what does this mean? The great Yah is the ultimate frickin' puppet master? You know, he's going to make this stuff happen just because he's got a number fetish or a fetish with everything lining up? There's a popular belief in Christianity that we are now living or about to enter sometime. Nobody knows exactly when, but they believe that the earth has been here for roughly 6,000 years, or at least since the time of the fall, it's been about 6,000 years, and that Jesus is going to come at the beginning of the seventh millennium, the 7,000 year. And that's why you have the reference in Revelation to this period called a 1,000 years, or the millennium, as they call it. It's going to be the seventh sabbatical millennium. So according to that concept, here again we have this this idea of numerology, and everything has to play out according to God's great plan. So guys, when you look at things like, you know, 9/11 and all the numerology involved with that, and similar events that have occurred on that date, as well as, you know, April 19th. And, you know, when we talk about these things and how it's big in Masonry, it's big in this book, too. This idea of things happening recurrently on similar dates and, you know, having numerologically coordinated, events and connotations attached to numbers, this all stems from this book, not the Kabbalah. That's a latecomer. Anyway, on the fourth day of creation, we're told that the sun, moon, and stars were created. You come over now to the seventh trumpet in Revelation 8, verse 12. It mentions sun, moon, and stars. The seventh vial that's poured out of God's wrath in Revelation 16, verse 8, mentions the sun as well. Look at these parallels. In on the fifth day of creation, we're told that the sea and air creatures were created. You come over now to the fifth trumpet in Revelation 9:11, 9:11, and you have darkness, abyss, a reference to the sea, so sea creatures. And then for the fifth vial, Revelation 16:10, we're told about darkness and the beast that come out of the sea. So a sea creature. I mean, you can't miss this stuff. It's right in your face. Anyway, the sixth day of creation, we're told creatures of the dry land were created. And lo and behold, when you come to the sixth trumpet, it mentions the Euphrates something's wrong. You know, well, anyway, the parallel to that is Revelation 16, or 9:14 and 16:12. What happened is it's a long story, but this is a chart I made up, and I tabulated it, and I had, a while ago, I reformatted all of my documents because they were so old, you know, this new word processor program couldn't even open them. So I had to copy and paste everything. It took forever to do it. Anyway, somehow in the shuffle, I didn't realize this tabulated chart I made up got all fumbled up. So now I got to go back and fix this. I don't know what goes with what. It got all garbled here. But anyway, on the seventh day, we're told was the Sabbath rest, the climax and end of creation. In the seventh vial, chapter 9, verses 15 and 19, we're told about voices and thunderings, you know, which seems to be a connotation to, you know, the divine, to God, the one whose voice blessed the Sabbath. And then we have voices and thunderings also in Revelation 16, 17, and 18 regarding the last vial of God's wrath that's pointed out. Anyway, it's, you know, just something interesting I thought I'd toss in there because it seems to hint of numerology as well. When you look at the days of creation themselves, the 6 days of creation, the first three seem to parallel the last three. Day one deals with light. Whereas day four, corresponding with day one, the first of the last three, we have God creating the sun, moon, and stars, which were given for light. Now, this is interesting because, of course, when you look at the sequence of events in the creation days, they make as much sense as a $3 bill. How can it say that light was created on the first day, but yet the sun, moon, and stars that were created for giving light, we're told, weren't created until frickin' 3 days later. But nevertheless, look at the parallels here. The first 3 days with the last three. The sun on the first day. On the fourth day, the first of the second set of 3 days, you have the sun, moon, and stars for light. The second day of creation was the waters were created. On day five, which is the second day of the second set of three, we have water creatures. See what's going on here. You got light, and then later sun, moon, and stars that give the light. Then you've got the waters were created, and then now corresponding with that on the fifth day, you've got the water creatures. And then finally on the third day, you have dry land was created. Well, that's ridiculous too. What are we supposed to assume, that the great Yah created the world inundated in water, and then later he made dry land? What the hell for? Why do it that way? It's only to have it come out this way, so that the first three parallel the last three. Um, a name for this in theological circles. It's kind of a chiastic structure, they call it. Chiastic parallelism. It appears that the creation story was written, invented, not to make any logistical scientific sense. Obviously, it wasn't written for that reason. It makes no goddamn scientific sense. No, it was written just to conform with this parallel structure type thing. That's it. Once you realize that these days parallel each other in that sense, now it makes sense. It's Kabbalistic type occultism, ladies and gentlemen. But in doing that, of course, they expose themselves, not in the mind of the Bible dupe, because they don't look for problems, so they don't see them, but they've exposed this story as the fraud that it is just on that basis alone. It doesn't make any scientific sense, but it does make sense when you realize they wrote this to conform to this type of numerological little magic trick here. Day three, once again, was dry land. Day six, corresponding with day three, was the creation of the animals and man that dwell on the dry land. You have this same type of thing kind of in the reverse. In the book of Daniel, you have this chiastic structure where in Daniel 2, you have Nebuchadnezzar's dream of empires. Daniel 7, and the way this works is Daniel 2, 3, and 4 correspond with Daniel 7, 6, 5. So these chapters parallel each other in the reverse order, 2, 3, 4, 7, 6, 5. Daniel 2 has the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, whereas Daniel 7 has Daniel's dream, but both of them foretell world empires. Daniel 2, you know, you have this image where, and I'll actually do shows on this sometime. It's actually pretty interesting to look at it. These aren't prophecy. These were written later with hindsight, and the illusion was created in foresight, you know. But it is interesting. Anyway, we'll pick up there with the bad guys. It's great.
Now, let's hear from a Jewish academic.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacists. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce it.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, so as I was saying, you know, in this dream of Daniel 2, Daniel has a vision or a dream of in the form of a statue of a man. It has a head of gold, an arms and chest of silver, thighs of brass, legs of iron, and then the feet are iron and clay. And Daniel is told that this represents five divisions of future earth history, of world empires that will rule until the end of time. And so that, you know, the head of gold is Babylon, the arms and chest of silver represents Medo-Persia, Greece, the brass thighs, iron legs of Rome, and then the iron and clay represent the last period, where there's some periods of strength representing iron, where, you know, briefly an empire will arise and then crumble. And the clay is, you know, weak periods in between where there's no strong empire, you know. Anyway, you go to the book of Daniel chapter 7. I'm sorry, did I say Daniel's dream? It was Nebuchadnezzar's dream, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Then later in chapter 7, Daniel has a dream that, you know, parallels the kings in that it covers the same time period, you know, the same idea of world empires. Except his empires are represented by these beasts that rise out of the sea. The first one is a lion representing Babylon. Then you've got a leopard beast, a bear representing Medo-Persia. Then a leopard representing, you know, Greece. A great and dreadful beast representing Rome. And then you got this little horn power that rises out of, it's 10 horns that represent the 10 divisions of Rome, you know, the barbarian tribes. That little horn, of course, represents the papacy, that when it rose up, it says it plucked up three of the first horns by the roots. When the papacy rose up, it overthrew the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, three of the 10 divisions of Europe. And, you know, Bible boppers wet their panties over this because they say, wow! Look how accurate this prophecy is. It foretold precisely these great world events. Yeah, right. What you have there, guys, the book of Daniel existed before the time of Christ. That's not arguable. We have references to it. Jesus himself made reference to the book of Daniel. It was known to have existed in the first century. But like all the other books in this damn collection of nonsense, the book of Daniel was altered, you know, over the centuries. It had stuff added to it and taken away from it. This prophecy, especially so detailed in Daniel 7, it was obviously added later with hindsight. But anyway, but no question, that little horn power does, in fact, represent the papacy, a power that the Christian world in general understands to be, you know, quote, the Antichrist. I'll have to do that sometime. We'll show on that, talking about the Antichrist prophecies. They do point a finger unquestionably at that bitch of a system over in Rome called the Vatican, the Catholic Church. It does. No question about it. But you got to love it because it's one tribal creation, pointing a condemning finger at another. It's all nonsense. Forget the whole damn thing. But, you know, you've had this going on quite a few times over the centuries. When I talk about Lincoln, probably, I don't know, next week, week after, some notes I'm working on right now, there were two major factions within the tribe in Lincoln's day. One, of course, being totally pro-slavery, run out of Benigne Birth headquarters there down in Charleston, and the other group, headquartered in the North, New York and whatnot, totally anti-slavery, whose wealth didn't depend on, you know, the cotton market and so forth. But, you know, looking back, clearly some of these tribe members really didn't care one way or the other. They just jumped on either bandwagon because that's where they lived. They lived in the North, they lived in the South, or they did it, you know, for other reasons. But clearly some of them were faking pro or anti-slavery. They really didn't care. They don't have a conscience. They don't give a goddamn, for the most part. They don't. It's just, you know, rhetoric. But amongst some of them, some of the lower level ones especially, who had small local businesses that depended on, you know, the slave trade or the you know, the cotton industry that depended itself on the slave trade, some of them did have genuine opposition to Lincoln, vehemently so. And so it looks like, you know, the real reason for his assassination, he did have Northern backers, tribe members that supported him. He also had, though, a lot of vehement detractors from the South, and it looks like they're the ones that orchestrated his assassination. The ones in the North, do you think they really cared, though? Ultimately, guys, their loyalty is with themselves. The pro-Lincoln tribe members weren't anywhere near as virulent in their support of Lincoln as the anti-Lincolners were in their aversion to him in the South. So the Northerners, you know, didn't care really so much. He got killed. You know. But as I'll point out, Lincoln himself, ladies and gentlemen, was a tribe member. Absolutely no room for doubt. Of course, that shouldn't surprise us, because when you look at the royal bloodlines, quote unquote, all of our presidents have had tribal blood in their veins. Every last one of them. But with this guy, he had quite a bit more than most other presidents. You know, it wasn't just traces of it going back several generations. You know, no. This guy was a tribe member through and through in every sense of the word. He was a Jew. No question. In his genetics, his background, the way he conducted himself, his belief system, everything. I did a show on him a while back, pointing out that, you know, he wasn't the great bastion of Americanism, you know, the true hero, the true patriot, blah, 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 blah. It's true, he wasn't. And I'm going to revisit some of that. But now it makes sense why. A lot of people think he stood up against the bankers. No, actually he didn't. The illusion that he did, but he really didn't, as we're going to see. He was the George Bush of the 19th century, trashing the Constitution. And he did it all for his tribe, as we're going to see. Anyway. That pretty much concludes, just seeing here, I had a couple of final notes, see if there's anything significant here. I guess that's it. Yep, I guess that's it. So let's move on now to start this JFK series. Very interesting stuff. when I did the JFK series years ago, you know, I covered it from different angles, but I didn't touch on this stuff, at least not enough. I mentioned a few Masonic connotations, you know, with the assassination, but I found out a lot more since. So let's take a look at that, the Masonic factor, the JFK hit. Many people are familiar with certain aspects of the JFK assassination having Masonic connections. For example, the school book depository is the site of the original Dallas Masonic temple. That location rests, of course, on the 33rd parallel, the day that Kennedy was murdered. Is highly Masonic, 1122, which of course equals 33. But there are many, many other Masonic overtones that most people have not noticed. So let's take a look at that now. First, there's the number 3. While 33 is an important number, of course, in Freemasonry, the number 3 is also very important. And it pops up quite a bit in the JFK saga, just like it does in the Bible. We just saw the number 3 is very important in the Bible. Pops up quite a bit. Anyway, let's not forget that according to Masonic lore, Hiram Abiff was supposed to have been murdered by three unworthy craftsmen. So three has always been an important number to Freemasons. Here's some examples of this number popping up in the JFK assassination. Trinity River is right near Dealey Plaza. JFK was killed by the triple underpass. There were three hobos photographed outside of the book depository. There were three assassins positioned to shoot at Kennedy, one, of course, in the book depository building. And I don't mean Lee Harvey. It was somebody else in that building. We'll get into that later. Anyway, there was one behind the grassy knoll and the one who actually fired the deadly shot. We'll get into that too later on. There were three other people in the limo, of course, with JFK, all of which were in on the conspiracy. Oh, yes. Yes, they were. There were three shots fired at the president. Kennedy suffered three gunshot wounds, back, neck, and of course, head. Recall that Hiram Abiff is said to have had suffered three deadly wounds as well. Dealey Plaza itself is triangular in shape. So, you know, number 333 popping up all over the place. By the way, regarding Kennedy's head wounds, I got to tell you right now, folks, the more you look into Kennedy's autopsy reports, the doctors didn't just lie at Bethesda. The emphasis has always been on, yeah, the wounds the doctors described at Parkland are totally different from what was described at Bethesda, so the Bethesda doctors are lying. The wounds were altered. Well, that's true. Yeah, the wounds were altered. Kennedy's body disappeared for quite some time, and they had plenty of time to doctor things up. Coroner's wax was used, you know, on and on and on. But guys, the Bethesda doctors were lying too. I mean, the Parkland doctors were lying too. They had their job to do, and they did it well. They were told what happened, all that happened in between Parkland and Bethesda with the alterations was they were changing their story to cover up where the deadly bullet really came from and who the guilty party really was in pulling the trigger. That's all that was being done. They changed their story. But if you look at the Parkland testimonies, at what, you know, the doctors were saying, they give conflicting stories too. Not only are their stories conflicting, but lo and behold, if you look at Kennedy's, the photographs from Parkland, it clearly shows one particular wound that is totally de-emphasized by the Parkland doctors. They don't even make reference to it. There is a shot that he took, and it's an entry wound, in the back of his head, slightly left of center. You can see it clearly in the Parkland Hospital photos. They don't talk about it, though. Some doctors from Parkland actually mention a wound, an entry wound, on the left side of his head, too. So that being the case, you know, it's hard to know where exactly, if you just go by these testimonies. You don't have to, though. There's other evidence to show exactly where the deadly shot came from. You don't need to go by what they said. But we have testimony of doctors, two at least that I know of, that said he had a wound on the left side of his head. But then you look at the pictures, and there's a wound on the back side of his head, slightly to the left of center. So, you know, going by that, it looks like he's probably had four or five wounds. Now, it's said that, again, Kennedy suffered three wounds, but that's, again, going by the official story. The neck and back wound, obviously, are the same bullet. He suffered a shot to the throat, which, you know, went through, you know, his throat and then out his back. We have pictures of that. We know that there's a neck wound and a back wound. They tried to alter it, of course, at Parkland by doing a tracheotomy, which is absolutely laughably freaking ridiculous. Why do you give a tracheotomy to somebody who's clearly already hopelessly, chronically dead? There was no saving him. He had the whole right front part of his head completely blown off. Massive hemorrhaging, I mean, you know, huge sections of brain were just falling out of his skull, you know, onto the stretcher. The parts that already weren't blown out of his head to begin with from the deadly shot. Denner didn't even know what hit him. It was instant death. But anyway, clearly, he took a shot from the front, through his throat, out the back of his body. And if you ask me, that shot came from the grassy knoll. That's why they removed the goddamn the windshield. Remember that story? Immediately, Secret Service took it, you know, to the local car wash, washed it down. Oh, removed and replaced the windshield so you couldn't see the direction that shot had come from. I'll get into later, you know, why that shot occurred. But that wasn't the deadly shot, obviously. You can see Kennedy in the Zapruder film grabbing his throat. And while he's grabbing his throat, it's very interesting to look at what was going on with the other occupants in that car. More specifically, it's interesting to notice not so much what they are doing, but what they aren't doing. Kennedy obviously was wounded. He's in distress. And nobody, Nobody shows any concern whatsoever. Not only that, nobody in that goddamn car is ducking, nor are they doing anything to ensure that he ducks. They're not doing anything to protect him. They're not pulling him down. Nothing. Anyway, we'll get into that more later. But that already right there is going to set the stage for what we'll be discussing. We won't get into that probably until Monday. I've got some other material here I'm going to cover first, including RFK's assassination. But I can't believe that people have never, for the most part anyway, you know, Kennedy assassination researchers, I'm talking the ones in the, you know, in the conspiracy world that know it was a goddamn, you know, government orchestrated event, know that the official story is a lie. I can't believe that so many of them have not taken notice of that extremely important fact. How can you miss that? Especially that little bitch wife of his. A woman who loves her husband and now sees that he's holding his throat and took a shot immediately is not only going to embrace him, she's going to pull him down, recognizing there are assassins out there trying to kill her husband. She doesn't even look at him. God damn it. You can't ignore that fact. You can't miss it. Isn't it amazing? You talk about hidden in plain sight. You can have stuff like that where millions of people have watched this and they don't even recognize it. It's right in your face. You talk about hidden in plain sight. Obvious major details that nobody has paid attention to. And why? Because they're not looking in the car. They're looking somewhere else. We're told to look at the book depository, you know, or the grassy knoll. Oh, and I'm not saying ignore them, because there was stuff going on there too. But that's the distraction, ladies and gentlemen. That's the function those shooters serve. The book depository shooter, not frickin' Lee Harvey, is probably the guy that fired the shot into the street, you know, that ricocheted off the curb. That was that shot, just distractionism. Firing from that distance, it was too risky. You know, that shooter was not going to try to take Kennedy out. It could have killed somebody else in the car. Not to mention, from that position, you really didn't have a good view of Kennedy anyway. It was a big oak tree outside the window there. You could not possibly have even seen Kennedy from the position where the limo was at that point. But likewise, from the grassy knoll. I said I was going to mention this later, but I might as well mention it now since I'm on this. The grassy knoll shot was far too dangerous for that to have been the deadly shot. Notice, the grassy knoll shot hit Kennedy low in the throat. This was designed not only as a distraction from the, you know, for the crowd. What did most people do when they heard that shot? They turned around and they ran toward the grassy knoll. They knew something came from the grassy knoll. Of course, something did come from there. It was a distraction from the public, but not just the public. That shot also distracted Kennedy himself, so that when the real deadly shot was fired, he was incapacitated. You can see, as the people are running, you know, from that famous shot, the famous photograph, you can see a puff of smoke coming from behind the goddamn grassy knoll. You know, there was somebody there. They did fire a shot. But the deadly shot, ladies and gentlemen, did not come from the grassy knoll. It was too risky. And it didn't come from the book depository. The grassy knoll shot was low. It hit him in the throat. Not only was this designed as a distraction, but it had to be a low shot. If, in fact, that shot from the grassy knoll was higher. If they, you know, if that, if the assassin took him out from that position and shot him in the head, that was above the line of the seat. The seat wouldn't have absorbed that blow. That bullet would have gone out the other side of Kennedy's head and could potentially have taken out somebody in the limo behind them, particularly LBJ, their little hero. They didn't want that. No, the grassy knoll shooter could not have been the one to fire the deadly shot. It had to be somebody else. Somebody else whose deadly shot would not have jeopardized the life of anybody else. By the way, I think Grassy Knoll shooter, his bullet might have actually ricocheted. Maybe he fired two shots. Who knows? We're told that only three shots were heard. So as to what caused Connolly's wounds is anybody's guess. Possibly the throat wound on Kennedy somehow ricocheted, although that's pretty hard. That one, I'm puzzled. I don't know what went on with that. The only thing I can think of is there were four shots fired. People thought they heard three. Maybe two of them were shot simultaneously. Maybe the ricochet shot off of the curb hit Connolly. I don't know. That is an enigma I've yet to figure out. But I know one goddamn thing. Deadly shot that took Kennedy out did not come from either the book depository or the grassy knoll. And the evidence of that is absolutely irrefutable and overwhelming. We'll be looking at that in coming days. Anyway, but, you know, when it comes to the wounds of Kennedy, guys, there's so much freaking deliberately orchestrated confusion as to exactly how many wounds he had. But we don't have to depend on the testimony of the doctors. That's kind of a side note issue. What we do have is pictorial evidence. Nobody can deny that. It's been there all along, right from the Parkland photographs. But like I said, we'll talk about that later. Not only that, but there's also some other very interesting pictorial evidence in the Zapruder film itself. As much editing as probably was done to that, no doubt. You know, for years that thing was locked away in the Time Life building in New York. They had plenty of time to doctor that up. There was doctoring, I have no doubt about it, but they didn't doctor it enough. There's still enough damning evidence in that film to point a finger in the right direction. Maybe they left it in there on purpose because they figured most people are not going to catch it anyway. Anyway, back to the Masonic symbology here with Kennedy's murder. Interestingly, on November 22nd, 1307, Pope Clement V issued the papal bull, Pastoralis Praeminentiae, which instructed all Christian monarchs in Europe to arrest all Templars and seize their assets. Now, what was going on here, guys, again, was infighting in the tribe, where the priestly line represented by the Pope was taking action against this emerging Freemasonic line that was trying to overthrow the monarchy and the church. All right, guys, short break. Be right back.
Buddy come from?
Well, little Jimmy, you see, the Jews print our money out of thin air and loan it back to us with interest, thus enslaving us through their usury.
Well, I never knew Jews were so good with money.
Yes, little Jimmy. That's why the Jews have been kicked out of over 109 places in 79 different countries for doing the same exact thing.
Wow. They certainly know how to parasite.
They sure do. That's why I bank with Shekelstein Credit Union. Shekelstein Credit Union, printing money out of thin air and enslaving the Goyim since 1913. Shekelstein Credit Union. They sure know how to parasite.
I'm an entertainment lawyer in Beverly Hills.
Welcome back. So again, notice the date. Pope Clement V issued this papal bull, lots of bull, which instructed all Christian monarchs in Europe to arrest all Templars and seize their assets. The Pope recognized that this newly emerging third way, if you will, where I did that show a while back on the third way, or the third wave, as they call it. That's what it is, guys. For the longest time, it was the two tribal factions that ruled the world, the church and the state, or, you know, the royal bloodline, the priestly bloodline. But now, beginning, well, even before this time, but it really started kicking into high gear in the early 14th century with the Templars, this newly emerging third tribal faction now, they all wanted the same thing, world domination for the tribe. But they were tired of the church and the monarchs, messing things up. Their argument was, you guys are going to fail. People are getting fed up with the tyrannical power of the church and the state. It's obvious that, you know, you're after power, and it's not going to work. There's, you know, people are wanting to rebel, and this thing, it's not going to last. What we are going to create is going to last, because we're going to fool people. It's still going to be a tyrannical system, but nobody's going to recognize it as that, because we're going to propagandize them. It's going to take us longer to do it, but it's going to last longer and be worth it in the end. Well, the church and the monarchs resented that. So here's the priestly bloodline represented by the Pope telling the royal bloodline represented by the monarchs, we got to band together here and wage war against these secret societies and their banking system that wants to take control. Don't forget, the Knights Templar were not only a Masonic type of secret society. They ran a very powerful banking system across Europe. This was a force to be reckoned with as far as the kings and the popes were concerned. So notice the date, though. November freaking 20. Excuse me. They always come in sets of two. Sorry, folks. November 22nd, 1307. Wow. The same date Kennedy was assassinated. You think that's by accident? I don't. It was exactly... Jeez, what the hell? This was exactly, I think I got another one. What the hell is going on? I think I'm allergic to Jews. Anyway, this was exactly 656 years to the day that Kennedy was shot. Isn't Isn't that interesting? Too bad it wasn't 1297. Then it would have been 666 years. But 656 years to the day prior to the Kennedy assassination, November 22nd. That's very interesting. Amongst other things, was the Kennedy hit Masonic Revenge against the Catholic Church, seeing that Kennedy was Catholic, for issuing a bull that ultimately resulted in the death of Masonry's hero, de Molay, 7 years later on March 19, 1314. You got to wonder. And they chose this date because it was what started the whole thing, the whole war against Masonry, against specifically the Knights Templar. Don't forget, these guys hold grudges for hundreds, even thousands of years. They're known for taking vengeance on one generation for something that happened many, many generations before. They don't forget. And what do they take vengeance for? Not because something, terrible was done to them, but because justice was served against them for something horrible they did in the first place. That's what they like to get vengeance for. How dare you? Or how dare your ancestors have stood up against us for our crimes? We're going to fix you now. That's the only thing, really, they have to be angry about. They get angry at those who get angry at them for crimes they've committed and want to take vengeance because you sought justice for their crimes. Jesus Christ. But if you ask me, guys, that's part of why they took Kennedy out. Sure, that played into it. Absolutely. It was revenge. He represented the institution that murdered their, one of their early founding fathers, if you will. This is a long-standing tribal infighting thing that was going on here. Anyway. Thanks, Sean. Sean just told me in the background, bless you for my sneezes. How many was that? Six sneezes? Jesus Christ, what the hell? Wow. I think it's just because the air is so damn dry. Anyway, let's look at Masons involved directly and indirectly with the Kennedy hit. Key players in the cover-up Warren Commission were high-level Freemasons, such as Chief Justice Earl Warren, of course, Mr. Alan Dulles, CIA director, fired by Kennedy, who headed up the freaking Warren Commission, Gerald Ford, another commission member, and another high-ranking Freemason, Senator Richard Russell, and, of course, scumbag Arlen Specter, the, quote, mastermind behind the sham magic bullet theory. What a crock that is. Ridiculous. So, in fact, the only Warren Commission member who wasn't a Mason was Thomas Hale Boggs, who, after starting to question the actions of the Warren Commission, conveniently disappeared in his private plane somewhere over Alaska. Remember that story? I believe I put a whole set of notes together on him. Yeah. In fact, if I'm going to do this right. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I did, but I don't see it. I'll have to look it up later. I'm pretty sure I did. That's an interesting story in itself. Boggs goes to Alaska there. I think he was campaigning or helping another friend campaign or something. And his plane disappears. To this day, officially, the official story declares that his plane was never found. Well, that isn't true. Absolutely is not true. They did find his plane. they'd just been lying to us. They knew exactly where it was. They shot the friggin' thing down. Well, they either shot it down or they rigged it to crash, whichever. But I'm going to look that up later and probably include it in this current series because it, of course, ties in with the Kennedy hit. But isn't that interesting? The only commission member who wasn't a Freemason and who began questioning the commission's tactics and, you know, conclusions and whatnot, turns up, of course, dead. Missing, but obviously dead. They killed him. Other key Freemasons involved with Kennedy's assassination in one way or another were, of course, LBJ, who, of course, took the reins of power right after Kennedy was shot. He hated both JFK and RFK. He was one of the main beneficiaries of this assassination. No question he was involved, guys, in a cover-up capacity. He was quoted by numerous people as saying that he wanted Kennedy dead. Barr McLellan, for example, who I met once by chance at a book fair in New York back in, I think it was in 2003. I don't even know who he was at the time, but he was there doing book signings. So I saw the name of the book, Blood, Money, and Power. I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. So I started talking with him, and I realized, oh, wow, this guy was a former attorney for LBJ. So I struck up a conversation, you know. Turns out, he's also the father of Scott McLellan, who was at the time Bush's friggin' press secretary there. Anyway, he said that on numerous occasions, yeah, LBJ told him he wanted Kennedy dead. So I got a signed copy of his book. Anyway, another name, Masonic name connected with Kennedy hit was, of course, Mr. J. Edgar Scumbag Hoover, FBI director, who also hated both Kennedys and had them both constantly monitored, spied on. Kennedy's office bugged. Abraham Zapruder, of course, was not only a high-level Mason, 32nd degree, but he had CIA ties and, of course, a tribe member. Conveniently, he just happened to be there and catch the whole thing on film, just like the Naudé brothers, who are also French frickin' tribe members. They just happened to be there and catch the first strike on the building, on the first tower on 9/11, the North Tower. Yeah. Isn't it a coincidence? They just happened to be there, and they happened to be tribe members. Even George Bannerman Dealey, though not involved in the JFK hit, was a Mason. It was he, of course, whom Dealey Plaza was named after. So, you know, they always got to have their little fingerprints all over everything because they're behind everything. Before going to Dallas, Kennedy stopped at Fort Worth, where some school children sang a song for him called The Eyes of Texas. This song was written by a Mason, Hank Thompson. But as we now scrutinize the lyrics to this song, it'll become painfully obvious that this song was chosen for a reason, knowing it would probably be the last song that he would ever hear. This makes me think, guys, of goddamn 9/11. When Bushy Boy is in the Booker T school there, you know, in Sarasota. And the kids are being given a reading lesson. You remember this story, right? And the teacher is pointing to the words on a, you know, written in big letters on a page or a notebook or whatever that she's holding. And as she taps the word, the kids respond by reading, you know, each word. And the words that she was having them read were plain steel must hit. Another one I think was kite. They threw that in there just for good measure. Or maybe that had some occultic meaning to it too, but it doesn't matter, guys. Do you really think that's a goddamn coincidence? Seriously? A lot of people you share this with, oh, they would. Yeah. Just like this is a coincidence now. The words to this song, take a look. Written by a Mason, the Eyes of Texas. Here they are. I once did know a president away down south in Texas, and always, everywhere he went, he saw the eyes of Texas. The eyes of Texas are upon you all the live long day. The eyes of Texas are upon you. You cannot get away. Do not think you can escape them at night or early in the morn. The eyes of Texas are upon you till Gabriel blows his horn. Jesus Christ. Sing me a song of Prexy, of days long since gone by. Again, I seem to greet him and hear his kind reply. Smiles of gracious welcome before my memory rise. Again, I hear him say to me, remember Texas eyes. But notice, the eyes of Texas are upon you. You cannot get away. Come on, folks. God damn it, man. You cannot get away, it says. Do not think you can escape them at night or early in the morn. The eyes of Texas are upon you till Gabriel blows his horn. I'm frickin' real, man. Just like the words the teacher read the morning of 9/11 in the Booker T. school there. Steel plane frickin' must hit. God damn it. Look how manipulated everything is. Totally planned, totally rigged. My God. Moving on. After the Kennedy coffin was removed from the center of the Capitol rotunda, you know, during his funeral, removed from the, you know, the Tundra Circle where it was on display, it was taken with pageantry to the street for viewing. The funeral procession made an unplanned stop, quote unquote, on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the Occidental Restaurant, and a picture was taken of the flag draped over the coffin with the word Occidental featured prominently over it, which, of course, means West in masonry and in the lore of the Egyptian jackal god Anubis. A dead person is said to have, quote, gone west just as the sun sets in the west. This was all by design. It was all Masonic, big time Masonic overtones. Finally, while JFK was buried at the Arlington National Cemetery, Oswald was buried at Rose Hill Cemetery near Arlington, Texas. So there's your Arlington theme popping up. How mind-warping. What a mind screw. As it turns out, lots of strange things have occurred on November 22nd throughout the centuries. And there seems to be repeating patterns in these events. For example, it appears to be, a day for a change in guard or a change in leadership. In the year 365, for example, Felix II ended his reign as Pope. So we have a change of guard, just like you had November 22nd, 1963. In 498, Saint Symmachus began his reign as Pope, replacing Anastasius II. In 1221, on November 22nd, Frederick II, Hohenzollern, however you pronounce that, was crowned Roman German Emperor. So look at all these things on November 22nd. 1707, Prince Johann Wilhelm Friso was sworn in as Viceroy of Friesland. Who the hell is calling me at this time? Jeez. Unbelievable. People know I do a show at this time. Anyway, 1918, the same date, Marshal J. Pilsudski became first president or dictator of Poland. Another change of guard on this same date. 1918, King Albert II's triumphant procession through Brussels took place. Another change of guard. In 1918, Frederick II resigned as Grand Duke of Baden. Look how many of these occur just in the 20th century now. It really whips into high gear. There may have been more that have been lost to us, but 1922, November 22nd, Wilhelm II formed a new German government. Also in 1922, the British Labour Party selected Ramsay MacDonald as its leader. 1926, imperial confidence ended, giving autonomy inside the British Commonwealth. On and on it goes. We got a caller here, other than the one on my cell phone. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hey, Charlie.
What's happening?
I think all this numerology and date information is fascinating, but it's very difficult to pin down, because if you look at the fact that there were at least two other credible plots, one on November 2nd at Soldier Field, where JFK was supposed to attend the Army-Navy game, in which two men were actually arrested, their names were never recorded, and they were released. And another plot on November 18th in Tampa, Florida, you would have to claim that those dates also had some significance. I'm not saying they didn't, but I just think it's very difficult to use numerology as any kind of proof. It's certainly interesting, and I believe the Illuminati, whatever, the Masons do often intentionally.
I'm not saying this proves anything. I'm just saying, in light of all of these other things we're looking at,
right,
and the fact that November 22nd is an important date for them, no question.
Right, right.
I mean,
anyway,
look at what are the chances that that date would be the date for so many regime changes over the centuries, especially in the 20th century?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what one would discern if you looked at the date November 2nd or November 18th. There very well may be some significance to those dates. But
yeah,
Anyway, I just wanted to bring up those other two plots and not to throw a monkey wrench into things, but just to state that one must be very careful in looking at numerology and all these things.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Charlie.
All right, buddy. You bet.
Bye.
Yeah, I don't ever put, stock in this, as far as some people get all excited and think that when a certain date is coming up, something's going to happen. And no, I don't, it wouldn't surprise me if something happens. But, I point this out just as, a very interesting curiosity. Do with it at what you will. But you can't ignore this. There's just too many of these. There's another one, 1940, November 22nd, 500 students in Delphi demonstrated against Nazis, or Delft, excuse me. Knowing that these people, guys, orchestrate events, they do from behind the scenes. They can have things happen, exactly as they plan. This is why, you have what seems to be the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. So many Christians get excited when things happen and they think that it's a fulfillment. Well, a lot of times they're just reading into what, things are the way they want it to be. But other times, like when you look at the seeming accuracy of the Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 prophetic fulfillment regarding the papacy's rise to power, blah, blah, blah. That's all that is their little playbook. Well, that was written with hindsight, but not the protocols. The protocols were written in advance. You could argue that a prophet must have written the protocols. Look how accurately they've been fulfilled. Almost none of which of the protocols was in place in 1905 when they first emerged publicly, yet almost everything since then has been put into place globally. How can that be? Are they prophets? No. They are the game plan writers, the script writers. They're just following or seeing to it that the script that they wrote out is carried out the way exactly that they had planned it. Anyway, there's more. There's more dates like this. 1943, November 22nd, Lebanon declared independence from French administration. 1960, the French National Meeting allegedly decided to build its own nuclear weapons, sort of a regime change. Nevertheless, a significant event on this date. 1963, LBJ sworn in as 36th U.S. president in wake of JFK's assassination. A regime change, of course. 1972, Belgium government of Eyskens resigned. 1975, Juan Carlos was proclaimed king of Spain. 1976, Algeria constitution went into effect. 1990, Dr. Amos Sawyer was installed as the interim president of Liberia. 1990, Margaret Thatcher announced her resignation as the British prime minister. This date also serves or seems to serve as a day of death, wars, and political turmoil. In 1346, street fighting broke out in Utrecht, Netherlands. 1861 was the Battle of Fort McKee in Florida. You know, the Civil War battle. 1864 was the Union General, the ordering of General O'Howard of the plunderers, you know, the ordered to be shot to death. All right, guys, pick up with that tomorrow. Lots more very interesting stuff over there. All right, guys, we'll see you then. Take care. Good day. Only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes in curiosity. Dust in the wind. All they are is dust in the wind. Say.
From the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion.
L'chaim, the principal object of our directorate consists in this, to debilitate the public mind by criticism, to lead it away from serious reflections calculated to arouse resistance, to distract the forces of the mind towards a sham fight of empty eloquence. In all ages, the peoples of the world, equally with individuals, have accepted words for deeds, for they are content with a show and rarely pause to note in the public arena whether promises are followed by performance.
Shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear.